thank you for tuning in to episode 198 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Wow, almost 200. If you have some ideas for how I can celebrate 200, let me know. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Just remember that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. Another thing to remember is that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. And how often do you get something genuinely handmade these days? If you'd like to sponsor this show, please contact me, or make a one-time donation via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, or monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. And Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, if you want me to travel more to do more exciting podcasts, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. And this week I will be talking about a presentation I gave to a group in Spain. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Andrew wrote to me, and just as an aside, because he included his mailing address, I did send him a couple of my bookmarks by mail. Andrew, I hope you have them by now. He said, "You and I had a friendly debate several years ago. I just sent you a small donation, and thanks, Andrew, for that. Since you and I last spoke, I actually worked in the HIV field for a couple of years. Coincidentally, I was curious of what your current view is on the HIV/AIDS hypothesis. My view has evolved, especially after working in the field. After seeing the correlation between positive HIV test, viral load, and T-cell count, and in my mind, perhaps most importantly, the effect the antiviral regimens have on these lab values, in my mind, the mainstream view essentially is conclusive. Whereas when you and I first spoke, I think my views were more aligned with your own. So I was just curious if your views had changed at all over the years. In particular, especially having now worked in the drug and alcohol field and now in HIV, I think the recreational drugs paupers hypothesis is obsolete. I remain open-minded on this topic, and certainly I'm skeptical of mainstream medicine and the pharmaceutical industry in general. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Feel free to publish them, although please do not use my last name if you do. As always, I love the show and appreciate you exploring these controversial topics and not being tied to any one political persuasion or set of dogmas. I listened to the episode, which I believe was focused on violence against men or false accusations, with a smile on my face. I believe I had accused you of being brainwashed by feminist rhetoric. LOL. I hope you and yours are well. Take care." This is how I replied to Andrew. "It's interesting you say that you've seen a correlation between a positive HIV test, viral load, and T-cell CD4 count. I'd be very interested in what science you have on this. First of all, CD4 counts are unusual without a positive HIV test, and so is viral load. Secondly, there isn't actually a good correlation between viral load and CD4 counts, and I cited a paper by Rodriguez in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled Predictive Value of Plasma HIV RNA Level, which is viral load, on rate of CD4 T-cell decline in untreated HIV infection. And they didn't include in the title that the predictive value is very low. There's very little correlation." A quote from the paper: "Presenting HIV RNA levels, that's the viral load at the start of the study, predicts the rate of CD4 cell decline only minimally in untreated persons. Other factors as yet defined to likely drive CD4 cell losses in HIV infection. So theoretically, the amount of HIV RNA, the viral load, represents the amount of virus, and CD4 cells are the type that HIV likes to kill. So there should be a correlation. Continuing, thirdly, we know that other factors affect CD4 counts, and to a lesser extent, we know this about viral load. For example, exercise makes CD4 cell counts go down, so exercise should be bad for you, and smoking makes them go up. So if drugs do raise CD4 counts, and it's not surprising that they do this because that's how they get approved for use, that is not proof. It is because they are killing HIV. And if CD4 counts are so important for the health of the immune system, why are they almost never considered for HIV negative people? Further, we know that there are people with high CD4 counts with classic AIDS and low CD4 counts without any negative health consequences. In fact, even zero CD4 counts. I quoted from a fairly famous paper by an author named Bird from 1996 in the Journal of Antimicrobial Chemotherapy. He said, the CDC definition of idiopathic CD4 lymphocytopenia does not include any clinical parameters. One group comprises a series of individuals who have CD4 counts which are low, but in whom there is no clinical evidence suggestive of immunodeficiency. So in other words, they have low CD4 immune counts, but their health is good, indicating that they're not immune deficient. It continues, some of these individuals have CD4 counts below the lower end of the normal range, and who have constitutionally low CD4 blood levels consistently over a period of time without ill effect. Their low CD4 counts may have no prognostic significance. I continued, paupers were tightly associated with AIDS at the beginning. All six original cases in 1981 had no known connection with each other, but all were heavy paupers users. It's less important now because of the use of antiretroviral therapy and other factors. And people are not diagnosed with AIDS-defining illnesses. They are diagnosed with a positive HIV test. And HIV antibodies are not necessarily associated with ill health. So there's no need to look for factors that cause the test. Basically, somebody who has an HIV-positive test will be terrorized into taking antiretroviral therapy. Consequently, they will experience many health effects, which will be blamed on HIV. I said there is much more on HIV tests, CD4 counts, and viral load here on a website that I manage, aras.ab.ca. And under the scientific information is information on tests, on drugs, and the testing includes information on CD4s, HIV tests, antibody tests, and viral load tests. I finished by saying I appreciate you appreciating a good debate, not just an echo chamber. I just interviewed David Steffen over a case in Calgary, Canada, regarding the Clark family. And perhaps quicker than I expected, the case ended with a decision. And so I thought I would bring David Steffen back to talk about the Clark case and also the continuation of his retrial, which is continuing. Okay, so I'll just get started and start asking you a few questions then, if that's okay.
Perfect.
I'd like to welcome David Steffen back to the show. Welcome back, David.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on, David.
We were just talking about the Clark case, and it came to a conclusion that, given the evidence that you reported from the trial, seems unjust. So, before we get to the decision of the jury, was there any more evidence given to the court after we talked?
There was not. We had talked on the Monday night there, and that was right following the testimony of former Chief Medical Examiner of Alberta, Annie Savageau, where she testified that the amount of fluids they gave him would have killed him, as well as the rate of the increase of saline would have killed him, or any normal person for that matter. And so there was no other evidence that came forward. Typically in a case like this, what you would see is where the accused would actually testify, but the case was so abundantly strong. The evidence did not stack up against them, that the defense actually felt that there was no necessity at all to have the parents testify because there was just nothing to back up the stated claims of what the official causation of death was being stated as, that being overwhelming sepsis or staph infection complicated by malnourishment. So there was no other evidence. There was just the following day, there was the final submissions from both the defense and the Crown, and that was really it.
And the Crown, for those who aren't Canadian, is the prosecution.
That is correct.
That's what we call the prosecution in Canada. So did you hear the instructions to the jury?
Unfortunately, I did not hear the instructions to the jury. I had my own court matters that I was dealing with that morning in Lethbridge, Alberta. And so I actually had an individual by the name of Ian Stewart come and report on that, as he had sat through my entire court case and had provided a sort of alternative media through written form during my trial. And so he was well-versed with what takes place during these types of trials and what the appeal issues were surrounding my case. So I had him go and sit in to see if there was any concerns over the judge's instructions. And his report, as you'd see from one of my videos online, is that there was actually no issues. The judge was pretty abundantly clear, based on the evidence, that the jury would basically have to find the clerks not guilty. Though he didn't come out directly and say that, he just emphatically stated many points that said, look, if this is the way it is, if there's conflicting evidence over this, you have to acquit them.
Yeah,
because
so
that provides reasonable doubt.
Right. I mean, that's one of the things I was thinking of is that the prosecution could argue is like, well, there were things that could have, would have killed this child, but what the parents did anyway would have resulted in death even if these mistakes in the hospital hadn't happened. It doesn't seem like a terribly convincing argument, but it is an argument that you could make. But you're saying that the judge is saying that if in that case that despite the fact that the hospital did things that could have caused a death, just because you think that maybe the parents could have also done that, you would still have to find them innocent.
That's
or not guilty.
Exactly, because it creates the reasonable doubt. And in this case, and this is why the defense didn't even put Jeremy and Jennifer Clark up on the stand, is because there was so much evidence that would create a reasonable doubt. So much. It was so overwhelming.
Well, let's go through that. I mean, what I have is the two hospital factors that could have caused death was the excessive amount of fluids given, and the second thing was the rapid raising of the sodium levels in the body. And then on the other hand, there was initially lack of evidence that there was an infection because they couldn't culture anything, and there was a lack of evidence of any malnutrition in the first samples that were taken. Now later samples gave different results, but in a case like this, it's obviously the first samples that are most important. So were there other factors that you think went towards, providing alternative explanations for the death or eliminating certain possibilities that could be the responsibility of the parents?
Well, the only thing that it would really come down to is, in regards to the failure to provide necessaries of life, is, was there a foreseeable danger? That did the parents see something and they failed to act? And so that could possibly, the thing is, we can't even get into the parents' minds on that. And so that's the only debatable point is, was there something else going on that they were aware of that no one else is aware of and they failed to act? And that's one of the things, is because the parents didn't get up on the stand, that was never verified. Or kind of washed away in that sense. So, I don't know if there's any other factors that could have led to the causation of death or anything like that.
Well, one you brought up earlier that I should have mentioned was this issue of a thrombosis, which is basically a blood clot, right?
That's correct.
That was a pretty reasonable alternative explanation for why a child would start to experience lack of circulation in a limb without it being the fault of the parents, unless you can somehow figure out how the parents caused the thrombosis.
Exactly. And so, yeah, you had the blackening of the toes that was beginning, and that's what became concerned to the parents, that and the hypothermia. And so when you take a look at it, those symptoms, the thrombosis could be an issue altogether on its own, and which is a fibrous clot, fibrous clots throughout the veins, and obviously restricts blood flow, and you end up with necrosis or blackening of certain areas as they begin to die. But then you've also got the hypothermia, which is a symptom of hyponatremia, which is that low sodium issue that he came in with. Now, when I was doing my own research on the weekend, last weekend, not the one that just went by here, but the one previous to Annie Savageau testifying, I was trying to figure out what would actually be a causal factor for both of those issues. Mm-hmm. All I could find was glandular issues in regard to hypothyroidism. And it's interesting because when Annie Savageau got up on the stand, she actually speculated, though she said, it's just mere speculation, that he had a pituitary gland issue, which is the master gland, and would control the function of all the other glands, and that he had a pituitary gland issue, which would verify why he was growing at a slower rate. It's not because he was malnourished, it's because there's a glandular issue, and that would actually substantiate why, or a causal factor for both the thrombosis as well as the hyponatremia coming from one root cause versus being two separate issues altogether. And so that may have been taking place, but that would be, really, I think, a typical parent. If this wasn't presenting with severe symptoms until it finally did and they brought him into the hospital, a typical parent, I think, would oversee an issue like that where you have pituitary gland issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit much. It seems like it would be difficult for medical experts to diagnose this, let alone parents. And, the parents didn't bring him in immediately, but, most parents, I remember when my kids were little, after a while you think, let's let this play out a little bit. Instead of rushing to emergency every time your child coughs or has a bit of a fever, after a while you say, well, I've seen this before, I'll wait and see if it gets worse. And at some point you go, okay, now we got to go to the hospital. It doesn't seem like not that much time passed between the early signs of the problem and when it got serious and they went to the hospital.
That's correct. From the sounds of it, it escalated quite quickly. I mean, he'd been unwell for a few days, and their main concern was ensuring that he was getting enough hydration because he was lacking an interest in breastfeeding and stuff like that. So they were taking proactive measures to ensure that he was still getting adequate hydration and whatnot. And that appeared to be their main concern initially. And it wasn't until the evening before that it appears that they became aware of anything going on with his toes with necrosis, or I would speculate a toe. It probably started off with one toe, as by the time they got to the hospital, it already spread onto the edges of three different toes. And then within a few hours, it was up to four, and then five toes, and then it looked pretty bad 21 hours later when he died, and then they took pictures of him in the hospital. So it escalated quite rapidly, the blackening or the dying of the tissue on the toes. So I don't think it'd be really foreseeable by the parents. How quickly that would take place.
Given that you have a rather mysterious and hard to diagnose problem potentially being the root cause of this, yet in the media it was this child is being starved and maltreated by crazy religious anti-vaccine parents, but none of that seems to be borne out by the evidence. You're saying that the first samples didn't show low nutrient levels, and also they seemed to be diagnosing an infection, and yet they couldn't culture anything from the first samples. And if it was thrombosis, then it probably wasn't an infection. I mean, it would have become an infection at some point, as gangrene set in, but maybe not at this point. How long did the jury take to reach a decision?
Not that long, actually. You know, they had two meals, so they had they got dismissed. They had their lunch, and then supper came in, and it was shortly after supper that they came out and they gave their deliberation. And it was interesting, actually, because I was the only one on the 12th floor, hanging out by myself there behind the security desk, just catching up on messages and stuff like that. And shortly after 7 o'clock, between probably 7:15 and 7:30, the majority of the jury actually came out. And you know, I was trying to analyze, you know, their demeanor and see, you know, how they were feeling, that type of thing, as they came out and they all passed me and they went to the elevator to wait. And it was pretty interesting to note, because I'd been analyzing them for the previous 3 weeks, as well as the judge. And what I saw was a demeanor that had come over all of them, that they were dodgy. You know, they couldn't make, you know, they'd glance over and kind of look away, like almost ashamed, or like they had just done something or were about to do something wrong. And so I'm like, oh, you know, maybe they're going home, maybe they're burnt out, whatever. I'm trying to rationalize it, because I'm like, heaven forbid that this is in regard to the deliberation they're about to make, because if so, I don't think it's going to be good. There's something going on. And sure enough, they went down the elevator. I never saw them come back up. But about 20 minutes later, a reporter comes up and says, oh, the verdict's in. I said, oh, that's interesting. I just saw the jury go down. And anyway, so we waited around, and I was like, oh, man, here we go. So I wasn't surprised, I guess, when I got into the courtroom. I was surprised overall, though. It just didn't make sense, especially watching the jury. And the jury was not really on board with the Crown. When I was watching the last submissions from the Crown to the jury wasn't buying it. If I was analyzing them appropriately, their body language, you know, their attentiveness, they just didn't seem to be buying what the Crown was selling. And the interesting thing was that the Crown actually engaged in some deceptive tactics that had to be corrected.
Right.
So the jury leaves, and that's supposed to be the end of it until they come in for the judge's instructions 2 days later. But the judge brought them back in, and the Crown had to go over some of the information and correct it, because it was extremely misleading. And so that was the last note that the jury was left with, was the Crown having to correct some of their deceptive tactics. And yet, we have this major, major shift, and it was a major shift. So it was surprising.
Yes. Now, also in Canada, nobody can communicate with the jury. In the United States, once the jury is finished, you can go up to them, talk to them. They can be interviewed on in the media. If it's a big case, they can give their opinions. They can talk about why they came to the decision. But in Canada, it's all supposed to be secret forever.
And it's unfortunate. In my opinion, it's unfortunate, because it sure would have been nice. I know in our case, as well as the new Jeremy and Jennifer Carr case here, it would have been really nice to find out what took place and what led them to the point where they would come up with a guilty verdict. And that's actually quite important in regard to sentencing as well, because now the judge has to really speculate as to how the jury deliberated and tried to build a sentence on that.
I mean, you were saying that the sentence could be up to 25 years.
Up to 30 years.
Up to 30 years.
25 years just for one of the charges, 5 years for the other.
Right. I think normally in Canada they run them concurrently, but 25, 30 years, what's the difference, really? I mean, that's basically life. It's interesting that you think the judge was trying to send a signal that there was a lot of conflicting information, and not all of it was putting a burden on the parents. In fact, most of it was pointing at the hospital as being the cause of the rapid decline and death. If the judge made correct instructions to the jury, is there any chance for an appeal? I mean, you're not a lawyer, but maybe somebody's talked about this.
I know it would limit the ground for appeal,
mm-hmm.
That you couldn't really go after the judge's instructions as being faulty if he's done a clean job, and if the trial was a pretty clean trial, which it was.
Yeah.
What I saw was the judge was adjudicating appropriately and not favoring one side or the other, like what we saw in my own court case. So in my court case, there was many grounds for appeal. With this court case, there would have to be something that I'm foreign to, and I'm sure there probably is grounds for an appeal. There may be grounds for appeal based on the fact that the judge identified that there was conflicting evidence and the jury still went against it. So maybe there's a possibility of going after jury misconduct, if there's such a thing. I'm not sure, but I would assume there would be something that they could go for.
Well, I guess we're both out of our depth on this. We don't really know.
Yeah.
We'll have to wait to see if the defense lawyer can come up with something. I mean, my opinion is, and I've been through one of my own trials with a jury, which backfired on me. It was a civil case in the United States, and my recommendation to anybody who's on trial, if you're in any way sort of going against the mainstream of society, to go with a judge only trial.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because I got sent an article while we were waiting for the jury, and what it was on was the statistics behind jury convictions versus judge-only convictions. And in criminal proceedings, statistically speaking, in the U.S., 84% of the time a jury will convict, whereas 55% of the time a judge will convict. And so statistically speaking, you're much better to go judge-only just in regards to the
staff. Right, and yet we, you know, in my case, we were told by the lawyers that, you know, the jury will sort of appreciate your situation and they'll understand it and they're more likely to be sympathetic than the judge. But I think in our case, again, the judge understood what was going on and the jury was out of their depth and was responding to emotions, not to the facts. And especially in this case where there seemed to be some pretty solid facts. But that's the kind of thing that a judge loves, right? Like, build a table and say, okay, what could have been the cause of the parents? What could have been the cause of something else? And they would have pretty soon seen that there was more than reasonable doubt.
Absolutely. I think if they went judge only and they had this same judge, I would say, based on his demeanor after he heard the guilty verdict, I would suspect that he would have acquitted them based on the evidence, because he appeared to be visibly appalled at what took place there, and he did something that I don't believe was done in my trial, where after the foreman stood up and declared guilty on both Jeremy and Jennifer for both charges, he actually went a step further and he asked each specific juror if they agreed. So he was very thorough on it, and each juror had to say agreed to it. And so I was watching him conduct himself, and he was actually having, in my opinion, a hard time keeping himself well composed as he thanked the jury for what they did, and then as he continued, he dismissed them and conducted the rest of the business, he looked visibly shaken by the whole matter.
Well, I guess it's not over unless there's no appeal. But with, I don't know, do you know if the appeal comes after the sentencing or if they can appeal before?
No, the appeal comes after sentencing.
Right.
At least that's the way it was in our case. That's what we were notified of. And so, which won't be until February. So it gives them a fair bit of time to decide what the grounds of appeal would be if they are to appeal. And, you know, it's a bit of a tough thing because, you know, you want to wait to see how the sentencing goes, because it could be extremely bad or it could be quite good. I mean, it could go so far as house arrest or even a suspended sentence if the judge really doesn't agree with it.
Right.
And obviously, in that situation, the Crown would be appealing for sure. They'd be appealing the sentence, seeking for more time.
The only way, though, and I mean, you stated this earlier, the only way the Clarks will get back their remaining two children is if they are found not guilty, if the sentence is overturned.
Right.
And this could be a long time. It gets to the point where even if they're found not guilty, it could be a year or two or three down the road, at which point getting their children back is just as disruptive as you know, anything else. I mean, there's no good solution for the family at this point.
No, and of course, it's a long wait.
Even if they receive a light sentence, say, 1 year of house arrest or a suspended sentence, that guarantees they'll never get their children back.
That's likely correct.
Not a guarantee, but it's probably close to it.
Yes, because even if they were found not guilty, it would still be an uphill battle to get their children back. That would be a whole new set of hearings. And I've seen how those take place as well with other families that have reached out for help, and Child and Family Services is never willing to easily let go of custody once they have it.
Right, and in criminal proceedings, they have the highest standard of evidence, so Child and Family Services might say, well, there was a reasonable doubt, but, we think there was a reasonable possibility these parents were at least partially responsible, therefore they're not getting their children back. They could hold the parents to a much lower standard of behavior. Is there anything else you'd like to add on the case of the clerks?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. We see how the parents and the whole family suffers from this, and it is a major travesty for them. But what many Canadians don't realize is that this is a major travesty for every single Canadian, because this has been quite likely the most historic case of its kind in ensuring and setting a precedent for medical system compliance. And so if people are concerned about medical system tyranny, this case has just solidified that. And so...
I see what you're saying is that basically you have to do everything according to the mainstream. So you have to vaccinate your children. You have to, in this case, maybe send them to a school. You have to have a standard diet that's not vegetarian. Like any of the things that you do that are outside the mainstream, even though in some cases they may be considered more healthy or arguably by some educated people would be considered more healthy, that won't save you if you're up against the prejudice of not doing mainstream, not treating your children in a mainstream fashion.
Exactly. Absolutely.
And you also had a court hearing, so is there any update on your case?
Yes. So, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I guess we'll see how it goes, due to the issues surrounding the previous three trials that we've had, where we finally end up in the Supreme Court of Canada, and our case is overturned and it was sent back to trial, all of those trials have added up substantially to the point that it's cost us approximately about $1 million, and so we're at the point where they don't pay you back for their own errors in law that were admitted through the Supreme Court. So we had to fire our lawyers, and so now we are self-representing, which is actually, in one sense, kind of liberating, being able to speak, as we feel necessary. And so based on that, as well as the fundamental breach in trust, being that the lawyers that we had, though they'd be great lawyers, were not willing to direct the case in the direction that we wanted to help expose a lot of the cover-up that's taking place, falsified records, destroyed records, withheld evidence, that type of stuff. So yeah, we're moving forward in that direction now, and so we just put the courts on notice that we will be making certain motions in regard to bringing all that to light.
Okay. And is there any? There will be a new trial. Do you know approximately when this will be?
Well, it was originally slated, the preliminary trial, for February of next year, and then the trial proper coming up in June of next year. And I'm not sure if that's going to continue on or not at the current rate. It may not. I'm not sure exactly how the whole system works there, but we will be bringing forward certain motions that may put a slight delay on this. I don't know. I don't know how it goes, but that's what it's currently scheduled for.
Okay. Well, I can make a prediction that we will be talking again in the future. Probably not in the very near future, because it doesn't sound like anything dramatic is going to happen, at least until the spring in either case. But I think your case and the Clark case are very important. And I don't know why in this part of Canada we're having these cases. I don't know of anything similar at this time anywhere else in the country.
No, there seems to be coming out of the Alberta Children's Hospital, and it appears to be some involvement from some people out of the University of Calgary that are really pushing this forward. So it appears that Calgary is the epicenter for setting this new precedent in Canada, where the scope or the application of these charges of criminal negligence resulting in death and failure to provide necessary life are being applied to people where it's never been applied to this type of people before, you know, deemed as loving, caring, attentive parents. And that's what the Clarks were, and that's what it was identified in our case as well. It's just a really peculiar thing that these charges are being applied to parents. And what the message is coming out as is that love just isn't enough. You need to fall in line with what our ideologies are within the allopathic model of medicine.
Yes, conformity is maybe more important than love if you're a parent in this part of the country.
That's the message they're trying to send.
And it could be a precedent for the whole of Canada, so this could spread to the rest of Canada as well.
Oh, it absolutely is. Yeah, no, these are not the precedent that is set in court is not exclusive or limited to the jurisdiction of Alberta. As soon as they're found guilty, now this case can be applied all throughout Canada and be referenced in any court case that may be of a similar nature.
Okay, well, it's not good news, but thanks for joining us today and sharing the bad news. It's good to get a bit of an analysis, and it'd be nice, maybe at some point in the future, we can get more of a legal expert to go into some of the legal issues that are a little bit beyond us, because I think that side of it would be interesting as well.
That would be awesome. And, you know, the good news to this is that the people are becoming aware, and they're actually rising up, and they're taking a stand, they're using their voices. So, you know, there's hope on the horizon. People are not willing to idly stand by and watch their rights be systematically eroded through the court systems.
Yes. Well, I hope this happens, because this is not rationality versus irrationality, at least not in the way that it's portrayed in the media, where the establishment is rational and the parents are irrational. It seems to be more the other way, or at least irrational behavior or mistaken behavior on the part of a hospital. And it's very convenient to cover this up by blaming the parents.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's a travesty for the parents. I mean, they're the ones who suffer immediately, but, you know, if this stands, all Canadians stand to suffer as well.
Okay. Thanks for joining us today, David.
Thank you so much for having me on again, David. I appreciate what you're doing there.
Okay. Bye-bye. Goodbye.
Bye.
Now for something completely different, actually, probably not completely different. I interviewed Raoul Eriks de Palma in episode 186. If you listen to it, you will recall that in 1995, he underwent heart surgery, that his heart problems were due to a serious injection drug habit, heroin, if I remember correctly, and that following his surgery, he quit taking drugs and started following a path of good health, including a vegetarian diet. It was a shock a couple of years later to test HIV positive, but he resisted recommendations to take the drugs and has maintained excellent health for about 20 years being HIV positive. He invited me to give a presentation to a local conference in Valencia, Spain. I couldn't afford to travel, hint, hint, especially at relatively short notice, but I did give a presentation in Spanish. I won't bore you with my terrible Spanish accent, but here is some of the presentation in English. I entitled it Resisting the Dictatorship of HIV and AIDS. Medicine has become a dictatorship, and this is, of course, directly relevant to the unfortunate outcome of the Clark case. It tries to control all our communications and that of doctors and scientists. It also tries to control our bodies. HIV/AIDS is a good example, but the dictatorship has spread to vaccines, cancer, psychiatry, and many other fields. The group Rethinking AIDS, and full disclosure, I'm the president of this organization, was formed in the 1990s by a small group of scientists and other skeptics who challenged the HIV equals AIDS equals deaths dogma and was named the Group for the Scientific Reappraisal of the HIV/AIDS Hypothesis. They attempted to publish their concerns in 1991, but it was not until 1995 that the journal Science accepted a letter from the 12 founders of the group, including Peter Duisberg, molecular biologist, Celia Farber, a journalist, Gordon Stewart, public health MD, and Charles Geschechter, who was a historian, professor of history. Now the group is known as Rethinking AIDS and has the website rethinkingaids.com. Controlling communications requires not only amplifying the voices of the powerful, but resisting the voices of the heretics. Peer review is the gate through which scientific publications and applications for grant funding have to pass. It sounds good, but in reality, it is ineffective at finding fraud, plagiarism, etc. But it's very good at imposing orthodoxy. An example, in 1987, Peter Duisberg was one of the world's most respected mainstream molecular biologists. Many people thought he would soon win a Nobel Prize, but instead he wrote the paper, Retroviruses as Carcinogens and Pathogens, Expectations and Reality, which questioned whether any retrovirus could cause disease in humans. HIV is a retrovirus, and thus Duisberg lost all his grant funding from the US government. Probably this was because in 1984, the US government declared that HIV was the probable cause of AIDS. By 1987, the word probable had disappeared from writings. And this is actually documented in a book by a guy named Epstein called Impure Science, that over a period of 2 or 3 years, the uncertainty surrounding the probable cause of AIDS disappeared, and HIV was the cause of AIDS without any uncertainty. Given that it was a Spanish conference, and Spanish is historically a Catholic country, I said that the AIDS establishment had essentially prepared a new religious creed where HIV is the devil, and allopathic medicine, drug-based medicine, is the god, essentially. Anyway, in kind of a religious tone, in 1996, the establishment prepared a formal recantation of Peter Duisberg's belief. They wrote a paper for Peter's signature saying that he retracted everything. He didn't need to write a single word. All he needed to do was to add his name to the list of authors. He was promised that he would be warmly welcomed back into the establishment if he did so. But he refused. In fact, what I heard was that he took the paper, he basically corrected it so that it was no longer a mainstream article, and he included all the questions about HIV and AIDS that he had, and he sent it back to them. They realized he wasn't going to play their game, so the article was published with this sentence: Peter Duisberg was invited to sign this article, but after some discussion, he declined. Peter Duisberg is not the only scientist of HIV/AIDS who has been censored. Rebecca Culshaw, a mathematician, wrote a book on HIV and AIDS and lost her job. Patricia Goodson, a kinesiologist in Texas, had a paper withdrawn and then reclassified. As far as I know, she kept her job but experienced a lot of pressure over the publication. Marco Ruggiero, a molecular biologist from Florence in Italy, had to leave the university and is now overseas. Andrew Maniotis, a biochemist, David Raznick, another biochemist, and Eleni Papadopoulos and the other members of the so-called Perth Group in Perth, Australia. Medical communications are controlled in different ways, and by this I'm talking about the communications written by MDs and other medical professionals. Supporters of the establishment are rewarded by grant funding, consulting fees from drug companies, praise from the media, graduate students, easy publication, and more. Heretics, even in small ways, have their message diminished. They get no rewards and may lose their medical license. In HIV and AIDS, it's difficult to find a doctor who will consider not prescribing AIDS drugs in most places, although a few do exist. And if you need one, contact me and I will privately send you the information that I have, if there is one near you. Journalists are similarly rewarded if they publish articles that the establishment approves of, but those who question the mainstream ideas are punished. Sunday Times writer Neville Hodgkinson was pushed out. Medical documentary producer Joan Shenton, who published several critical documentaries in the early days of AIDS in the late 1980s, early 1990s, was unable to produce documentaries anymore. More recently, she's received some private funding to do some, again, controversial documentaries. Celia Farber wrote for Spin magazine and other magazines and was completely blacklisted. Chuck Ortlieb published the gay New York native newspaper, and his newspaper was run out of business. And John Lauritsen, who is a gay man and who wrote on a lot of different issues, AZT, and specific issues related to gay men, also received tremendous pushback. And the investigative journalist Liam Sheff, who unfortunately died a year or so ago, but his work will live on. Particularly in the case of AIDS, if you're a woman and are HIV positive, or have a child that is, or both. There are some cases where a child is positive and the mother is not, for example, an adopted child. Your child could literally be torn from your breast. This is because you want a natural birth, you want to breastfeed, or you refuse toxic drugs like AZT, also known as Retrovir, and azithromycin, and nevirapine. Even if you simply ask questions about the toxicity of the drugs, you could lose your child. And listen to this. The label of AZT states, toxic by inhalation, in contact with skin, and if swallowed. Target organs, blood, bone marrow. If you feel unwell, seek medical advice. Wear suitable protective clothing. AZT is also listed as a carcinogen in the state of California. And yet, if you're an HIV-positive mother, or anyway you have an HIV-positive child, you'll be forced to take this drug or forced to give it to your child. If you're seropositive and sexually active, especially if you're a heterosexual man, your antibodies are considered a deadly weapon. If you have sex without telling your partner you're HIV-positive, or if you do tell your partner and your partner later denies this, then you could go to jail for about 2 years or more for each sexual partner. The courts simply assume that HIV is a deadly sexually transmitted virus, and the assumption has rarely been tested in court. Carl Leone in Canada, for example, received a 21-year sentence, for example. Even without sex, HIV antibodies are a crime. A Texas man received a 35-year sentence for spitting on a police officer, whereas if he had been HIV negative, it still would have been a crime, but would have been punished much, much less. If you're a gay man, Latino, or black-skinned, you will be deluged with propaganda. You will be told to take drugs even if you are HIV negative. This is called pre-exposure prophylaxis. You will not be informed of the side effects of the drugs. You need to inform yourself. A lot of the organizations that are trying to counter the propaganda that we're deluged in the area of AIDS or vaccines or psychiatric medication or other areas, they don't have a lot of power and money. The best that they can provide is information, which means that you need to go out and find it if you have a particular need. You can, in most cases, overcome the propaganda just by informing yourself and resist by refusing to be a victim, by assisting those who are victims of the system, and by dealing with your health problems as much as possible outside the allopathic medical system. But still, if you get hit by a bus, the emergency department and the allopathic medical system is probably the best. But if you feel sad or you have some questions about vaccines or you're diagnosed HIV positive, it might not be the best thing to do to follow their advice. I concluded by saying that truth will live forever, and the profitable lies of the HIV/AIDS death dogma will eventually die. Thank you for listening to episode 198 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, episode 199, thank you and goodbye.